It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
I was always very interested to meet you. I'd heard so much about you from Vespa. If she hadn't killed herself, we would have had you too.
Are you going to tell us who you work for?
The first thing you should know about us is that we have people everywhere.
I thought I could trust you. You said you weren't motivated by revenge.
I'm motivated by my duty.
I think you're so blinded by inconsolable rage that you don't care who you hurt. When you can't tell your friends from your enemies, it's time to go.
You don't have to worry about me.
Restrict Bond's movements. Put a stop on his passport. Find Bond.
How long have I got?
30 seconds.
That doesn't give us a lot of time.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? I'm Paul Spitero, and we have once again gathered our James Bond bunch together, this time to look at Daniel Craig's second film, The Quantum of Solace, whatever that means.
it's a tiny amount of solace.
Apparently, Quantum of Solace is to show people respect. That's what that expression means. I had never heard it, but that is apparently what it means. Anyway, joining me as always is my Is It Yours partner, Mr. Sean Whalen.
Pleasure to be here.
It is a pleasure to have you. And we have our usual assortment of James Bond rogues, starting with Brian Hughes.
Hi.
Chris Tyler.
Aloha.
Jeffrey Vaughn.
Hello.
Dave Pascarella.
How's it going?
And last, but certainly not least, my good buddy, Mr. Scott H. Gardner.
Hello, how's it going?
And I think in this case, the H stands for how the hell did they make this movie?
Quickly.
I'm going to get, you know, it took 5 years between this and Casino Royale. It was not quickly.
Yeah, but it was still quick because of the strike, right?
Right. Yeah, well, I think that might go to a lot of my criticism of this movie, but we'll get there. I saw this when this was announced that it was coming out. I got very excited because, as is demonstrated in the last time we all got together, I loved Casino Royale. And then when I saw this, I walked out with my jaw like dropped, saying, what the hell did I just watch? Now, I have seen this in a total of 3 times. The second time I watched it, I did it as a double feature with Casino Royale, and it plays much, much better under those circumstances.
Yep.
The third time I watched it was this week for the purposes of getting together with you gentlemen. And I was once again, because I did not watch it with Casino Royale, once again having difficulty following some of the scenes, having difficulty following some of the storylines. It was, to me, quite frankly, to give you, you know, to put my review right up front, I think this movie was a little bit of a mess. But we'll get further. Let's go around the table and get some initial impressions. Sean, you're up.
So I saw this in the theater and rushed to the theater. I'm a Bond junkie. I love Bond. I love the books. I love, you know, anything Bond is kind of my thing. This is the movie I forget out of the batch, which is really interesting. Like when we said we're going to do Quantum of Solace, I was trying to remember what this one was about. Then I saw
it 2 days ago and I can't tell you what it was about. Go ahead.
So I agree with one of the things you said, and it was something because you and I had a conversation before this recording about watching it back to back with Casino Royale. My wife and I did that. Definitely highly, if you're listening to this and you haven't done that, it's the way to watch this. It does add a lot to it. You jump immediately from that movie into this one because these movies were geared to be, clearly the intention was for this to be multiple chapters of the Daniel Craig saga. And from that perspective, there's things that work in this that I do like. But it's an interesting movie as far as where I think it fails isn't the right word. It's a roller coaster of a movie. And I don't want to dominate all the time with that. So we'll talk about it organically as we get through. It's an interesting movie to talk about. I think this is going to be a fun discussion because I can see everybody having their own little flavor on this one.
Ryan, what's your initial thoughts?
Well, I saw it in the theater when it came out first day, and the theater that I was at had a problem with their air conditioner.
Oh,
and so it got really, really hot. So every time they had like the desert scenes and stuff like that, I was dying. I was dying.
You had and
I
was friends around. What are you bitching about?
Yeah. So, you know, the movie gave me, I had a sour taste in my mouth from that. I love the beginning of the movie, except for the quick cuts. And I was like, okay, this is interesting where it's going. And, you know, with the environment that I was in, I just couldn't enjoy it. And I couldn't say whether it was a good or bad movie because I was just so, you know, involved with the heat that was going on where I was at. Wound up getting free tickets to see something else. I forget what I did see, maybe Iron Man, but it just it was soured by that. But I did get both Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace on disc a year later, and was able to sit down and watch them. And then watching them back to back is a good experience in that way. But I still have that kind of flashback every time there's a desert scene.
What do you think, Chris?
Just like the fact that I had to catch up with Daniel Craig on home video after Casino Royale had come out and was able to be purchased, I had to do the same with Quantum of Solace. I did the lapse in time. I forget where I was in my life, but it was just like, I'll get to it. And watching it without rewatching Casino Royale first... yeah, it's tough. The movie is a mess. I do enjoy it as a prolonged denouement to Casino Royale. It's really the only way to watch it. I don't hate it. We haven't gotten to the Craig movie I hate yet, but I'm sure we will. It's a weird hodgepodge of a movie, and the quick cutting thing, that's when you don't know how to stage action, you just do quick cuts because you don't know what the hell you're doing. And that's exactly why the beginning of that movie looks like that, because I think they were pressed for time and they needed to get this is like the shortest one too, right? It's only like an hour and 40 minutes.
Yeah, it is the shortest one.
Yeah, film. So they were,
but as a non-director, just to touch on what you're saying, maybe if you threw in the occasional establishing shot, it would help.
And yeah, it usually does in most movies.
Instead of close-ups and then extreme close-ups. Yeah. Jeff, what do you say?
You guys are touching on it. You're being too kind, but you're touching on it. This this is probably the one I was looking forward to the most, because as you guys remember, I adore Casino Royale. I think, you know, and I think Casino Royale is the best. So I was primed. They were doing the thing I, as a fan, had always wanted them to do. As a writer, I had always wanted to do, which it is, they're eating straight into this movie from the last one. That's, and it was just, I mean, just phenomenal. And then what Chris just alluded to, which is the quick cuts and in the whole first 3 minutes of the car chase, the longest shot is a medium close-up. Now, once they get out of the tunnel, you see some establishing shots. But seriously, it's just a mess. And, you know, we'll get into the ups and downs of this movie. Its most offensive thing to me is the level of disappointment, because they've got a great cast. They've got the beginnings of a great premise. They've got a lot of good situations. But I think the thing that I would sum it up with, in the Ken Burns documentary Baseball, George Will describes football as gang violence punctuated by committee meetings. I'm a football fan, but I can admit that that's true. Mm-hmm. That's what this movie is. The action scenes have no relation to what's going on. They are just there as action scenes. It is James Bond paint by the numbers. And again, I love the cast. I think some of the meaningful stuff, it just makes it even that much more frustrating, because there's these moments they get just right. But I think the whole film can be summed up by, they have a hotel that is designed to explode, and it does not disappoint.
They have a movie that's designed to explode.
Oof. That's my initial two cents.
Dave, now your opinion I'm really interested in hearing, because unless I'm mischaracterizing it, you were resistant to the Daniel Craig Bond, yes, until we got to it, and then we kind of won you over with Casino Royale, and then you come into this, and what do you say?
Well, I didn't have the problem, because I had just watched Casino Royale relatively recent when we covered that. So my memory was fairly good, for what it's worth at this stage. I found this movie to be probably the most violent of any James Bond movie I've ever seen, with zero or minimal levity to it. And the thing that stuck to me right out of the gate is that car chase in the beginning, where the two cops are pursuing, they get killed, I'm assuming. Whereas in previous Bond movies, you'd have, you know, they wreck the squad car and you see him climbing out. None of that in this movie. It was just, I felt cranked up to 11 with no levity or minimal. And the other thing that stuck out that was kind of ironic to me in this movie was, we were thrown a lot of things you don't typically have. And the thing that stuck up was the crappy car and the crappy boat, which the electric car in the beginning in Haiti. It's like, you know, in the old movies, she would have pulled up in a Mustang or a Camaro or whatever. And then he jumps in this boat that looks, the thing, you know, I amuse myself with this. I'm thinking it's like he gets in Sanford and Son's truck and is able to take off going 95 miles an hour in a 55 truck.
If only the score had that music.
Yeah. That's really disturbingly accurate.
You know, something that he just said, cued something off of me that I don't want to forget to say. One of the things I found with this one, especially when you're talking about the action sequences, is that in the first one, Casino Royale, there was passion around the action sequences. The story was leading to all of those things, and there was like emotion behind it. So this one was much more violent. Totally agree with you on that one, but it lacked the emotional resonance that it should have had for what they were hitting us with. And I felt like that was something, when you watch it back to back with Casino Royale,
I feel like this story makes more sense because of the back-to-back with Casino Royale, but it also, it's almost feels like some sequences have this little bit of a decline, never falls fully. I like the film. I want to be clear. I do like the film, and I might be in a minority on that one, but I don't love it. And I feel like with certain things that are happening here, I feel like I should be loving this movie, and I don't. And it's the passion, I think, is the piece that I'm missing. That emotional resonance that Casino Royale left me with is not here.
Sean, can I offer something on that?
Please.
Okay, so like in Casino Royale, we opened up and we wound up with some cool stuff. And we had the parkour chase, which was like one of those stand-up scenes in the movie. This one, it felt like Face Off or you know, some other John Woo flick where they had a whole bunch of stand-up action scenes they wanted to do. And so they had to frame a movie around it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so like they had that one battle where there's everything's swinging around and the gun's down on the floor and, you know, you get Vonda sit there and go down to the bottom of the rope and get the gun. It was just, it felt like it was all just set up for those action beats. And I forgot that they had to have a plot.
I couldn't even imagine how you could film that, let alone do it in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then as far as the boat scene goes, it, for whatever reason, it made me think of the gondola boat race in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. I guess just because there were wooden boats getting beat up. Though I did like the whole thing of the wooden boat versus a Zodiac. And that went exactly as it should have gone.
Scott, you're up.
I actually did see this one in the theater. I took Scotty, my oldest boy, to see it. He had just kind of discovered James Bond. I think he was about 12 because this came out in 2008. Is that right?
Yep.
Is that right? Yeah. So he was 12, and I think Casino Royale was his first Bond. So he was kind of enamored of that movie. And, you know, so when he showed an interest in wanting to see this, you know, based on the trailers playing on TV and that sort of thing, I was like, yeah, sure, let's go. So I took him to the movies to see it. And my lasting impression of that experience was that he fell asleep during the movie, which I don't think speaks, you know, very highly to his enjoyment of it. I enjoyed it. I still enjoy it. I think it's a good James Bond movie. But that's with a couple of caveats. One, I think it does drag a bit in the middle. It's while it does have some action in it, it's not as action-y as the movie before it. And as you guys stated, I'm glad it wasn't just me because I was going to bring this up and ask you guys, was the action a little hard to follow? Clearly, you know, by your discussion, you thought the same thing.
Yeah.
But I also find, you know, a lot to like about this one as well. And we can get into some of that as we go along, but overall, I really enjoyed it. My other, caveat with this is that, it's not a standalone movie by any stretch. And as we sat down to rewatch it, you know, for doing this episode tonight, I watched it with my son, Logan. And as we sat down to watch it, both of us were like, do you remember what the hell was going on in Casino? Like, where are we in the story? And he's like, oh, God, I don't. And I didn't really have time to rewatch Casino Royale. So he hunted up a video on YouTube that ran about 4 minutes that was just like a real quick encapsulation of Casino Royale. And I'm really glad we watched that because I think if I'd have gone into this movie again, even having seen it like 3 or 4 times now, I think I would have been like, I don't know what the hell's going on. So I don't know what that says about the movie, but it you know, it is much better paired with Casino Royale, as you've said, but also I don't think you can walk into this one cold. And I'm not sure how I feel about that. I love the fact that it picks up right where Casino Royale left off. I like when movies do that, to where it could almost be edited, you know, and be one continuous movie. I kind of like that. But at the same rate, that's something completely new to James Bond as well, to where every other one was, you know, they were their own thing. They were their own episode, and you can walk into any of them.
You had elements where the chase for Blofeld went from movie to movie mm-hmm. by reference.
Right.
But this is far and away the only time this has been done. To me, that's why it has that extra weight to carry, and why it's extra disappointing to me is because it did it so poorly. And yet the scenes that are really about that are among the movie's best.
Right.
You know, so I think there's so many things about this. You were talking and I jumped in. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. No, that's fine.
Well, the other thing is what Sean said about, let's call it the passionless violence. I think the real comparison for me, if we're really diving into Casino Royale, in the black and white sequence where he's getting his 00, the fighting the guy in the restroom. And that's brutal fighting. It's every bit as brutal as the scenes in this. But story-wise, there's a purpose for it. And what I get by comparison to the fight in the hotel room with the guy, for everybody who just rewatched this very recently, I just watched it this afternoon, is that M keeps telling him, don't kill everybody, and he keeps killing everybody. And then there is that thing of what you said about it dragging in the middle. Okay, it's dragging in the middle, and it's the shortest Bond movie.
That's tough.
Yeah,
that's tough to do.
Now, one of the things about it, you know, I'm going to level a lot of different criticisms as we go along, but and I will have a couple of positives, but overall, I got to tell you, my view is more negative than positive. But one of the negatives I have is that the big bad in it reminded me of Pee Wee Herman.
Oh, now I'm just never. I will never unsee that now.
And his son,
I'm not
Dwight from what the hell is it?
The Office.
The Office.
Yeah, I mean, it was hard to find him as a, you know. I am one of the few people on the planet who actually liked Never Say Never Again, and I know I understand I am in the extreme minority on that.
I like it,
but in that movie, Klaus Marie Brandhauer, I always felt he was less than an adequate threat for Bond. I didn't mind the older villain who's sitting in a chair and isn't going to be a physical match for Bond, like in The Spy Who Loved Me. I was okay with that. But when the guy, when they try to say, oh, he's angry, we got to be afraid of this guy, I want him to be threatening. And the two of them reminded me of each other in a lot of ways. And that's one of the areas, it's one of the lesser failures of this movie, because I have bigger fish to fry on that, but that was one of the things that as I was watching it this time, I was like, who thought of casting this guy as the one who we need to be afraid of in this movie?
Yeah.
He was the one guy I wanted to see Bond shoot, and we didn't get to see that.
I think that's just, but again, is that the time frame though where they're trying to, I mean, if there really was an organization that we come to find out is actually quote-unquote Spectre, in the modern era, wouldn't they just be slick Eurotrash assholes like that? Like, they're not going to be guys with, you know, metal teeth. Like,
we had a lot of criticism for Die Another Day, and we had a villain of that ilk, but I still found him to be a more credible and more enjoyable villain in that movie than this guy.
Are you talking about Green?
Yeah.
Dominic Green, yeah.
Did he remind anybody else of Bill Mumy? Because he looks a lot like Bill Mumy.
He does later stage Bill Mumy, doesn't he?
I was too locked into the Pee Wee Herman comparison.
Yeah, I honestly can't unsee the Pee Wee Herman since you guys said that.
He actually reminded me of Nikita's boyfriend in La Femme Nikita, the original. It was a different guy altogether, but they had that same wimpy countenance, you know.
You mean the Luc Besson original?
Yeah,
Logan. I swear to see that. I'm not 100% there, but I can see what you mean.
Yep.
Logan had a really good observation. Something that totally cracked me up when the girl, I can't remember her name, the redheaded girl,
Oh,
Fields.
Trips his assistant, and he falls down the stairs, and his hairpiece comes off.
Yeah.
Logan goes, that dorky haircut was a toupee?
Yeah. I think that was my reaction, too.
So... I'm gonna get to my major criticisms on this one, and it really is twofold. And one we've already touched upon is the direction slash editing, which I feel makes portions of this movie totally incomprehensible. But then you add to that the fact that the script brings us from scene to scene without proper segues, without proper explanations from why. And in the past, I've been okay with Bond doing that to me. You know, all of a sudden we're going to Jamaica, and then we're going to England, and then we're going to, you know, wherever. And I have to say to myself, why are we doing that? But if I rewatch it, I could see I missed a little bit of dialogue that brought us over there. I don't even think that happened in this one. And I think, you know, Chris hit on before that the writer's strike was coming on, and they rushed the script on this. And I think the script is extremely lacking. I mean,
unfortunately, that's a problem with modern screenwriting in general. It's an and then this happens movie.
In this particular one, when the writer's strike happened, they had the script they had. The script didn't tie Casino Royale and this together. Daniel Craig and the director were the ones that actually went in and tied it all together and basically forced that into it. And those were the best parts of the script in this.
That and the relationship between Bond and M, I still think kind of had some weight to it that I liked. That's about it.
Well, I want to say also the relationship between Bond and Mathis. Mm-hmm. Which was counterintuitive given what happened in the previous film, but story-wise made sense in this one. And spoiler here, when Mathis dies and is telling him that he needs to forgive Vesper and himself, that's actually the only scene in the movie that has any real weight to me.
Mm. Yeah, And there was some weight to the fact that he left his body in a dumpster, and they were like, "You're going to do that?" And he was like, "He would have wanted this.
He wouldn't have cared." And I let me back up. I should backtrack. The scene where he's done away, where he's knocked out the guys that are taking him into custody, and he passes by M again. There's a good bit in the relationship with them and with between her and Tanner.
Mathis is one of the things that really works for me in this movie. And when he dies, that whole sequence really it just breaks my heart, because I liked that character a lot.
He's such a good actor too.
He is, yeah, he's phenomenal. But I just have a quick question. Can somebody explain? I'm lost with what happened with Mathis from Casino, because I remember they come in and like take him away or something, and then in this one, Bond goes to him and
he was the one who stole the money.
Right. Okay. Now
they stole the money.
Yeah.
He thought Matthew had betrayed him, so they took him off to sweat him. When it turned out it was Vespa, then they kept sweating him, but still determined that he was innocent. And so
they bought the house that he and that girl were living in.
Right. Yeah. I caught that in the dialogue about that, you know, that they made it right by him. But I'm like,
in other words,
I miss it every time.
Vesper, there's a Judy Dench references in Casino Royale. Vesper being guilty doesn't mean he was innocent. So they keep sweating him.
But I think, Jeff, I think you hit on something earlier when you talked about the weight of that scene when he says to forgive Vespa, because I think it gets added weight to it when you consider the fact that he suffered so much for her betrayal, and then he's the one saying forgive her.
Yeah.
So I do think there's a lot of weight to that.
And he added a comment earlier in this movie, matter of fact, about the perspective of age and Bond being younger in this. And him being an older thing and saying that you don't see things so clearly, so cut and dry. I think that, like I said, I found that the weightiest scene by far in this movie.
Bond was also a big factor in his continued torture. If you remember at the end of Casino Royale, is that what was going on? Bond, like, kind of influenced that continuing on as well.
Absolutely, Sean.
So it was, there's four things in this that I really, Scott, you mentioned earlier about things to like in this film, and I agree with you. And there's certain things for me that I liked that I wanted even more of. Like I'd like to see them build off these ideas further. One of them was Mr. White. So we had this ending of the last film, and I wanted something more satisfying with him because that was my motivation at the start of this.
Yeah.
I liked it. I liked what they were doing with it. I liked the chase in the beginning. And then I'm like, we're not going anywhere with that other than we see him in an audience. I wanted more out of that, which I know this is a chapter in a larger story, but one of the things this is lacking, I feel, out of Casino Royale had a satisfying ending. This had a good ending, but I felt like I needed the same kind of feeling that I got at the end of Casino Royale. Lighter. I think they were doing some really cool things with Lighter in this that I wanted more of. I feel like we were setting some opportunities for him to maybe have a cooler role in this, even than he did. He did. His moments were cool. I really like him as Lighter. I think it's good casting. I like his interplay with Daniel Craig. I feel like the two of them feel like Jack Lord when I see Jack Lord as Felix Lighter. I get the vibe. The vibe for me is something that's really important.
He's got his own cool factor. It's not reliant on Bond.
I think that is borne out a little bit by the acting of Daniel Craig and Jeffrey Wright.
Yeah.
But I don't think the script does them any favors. I think they had to work hard to create that chemistry and that relationship, whereas the script could have given you a couple little things where you show that they're, you know, they have different ways of looking at things, but ultimately they're becoming like brothers over time.
It came across in their chemistry came across in the physicality of their movements and their interaction with each other. It wasn't in the words.
Yeah. And I think the words could have been a little bit more meaningful.
I wish they could have found more to do with David Harbour, because David Harbour's beam was just like, oh, you just hated him. And he had that porn stash and he just smarmy as hell. And you just wish they'd done more with him. I didn't even realize it was David Harbour.
That's my favorite thing you can say about an actor. I forgot who it was, and I know all these other.
Oh, as soon as he came on the screen, I said, "Look, it's Hopper."
Yeah.
I think his part could have been a little bit expanded, but I think, you know, he wasn't the name actor back then that he is now.
The thing about Mr. White, though, that was interesting is that in the first sequence, after they got him out of the trunk and are talking to him, and he's laughing, saying, you guys don't know anything about us. In that moment, he reminded me of the old bald guy on Benny Hill, you know, the one he was always mad at. You see it, don't you?
I mean, wow. That would have been a different musical choice.
One of the better, I don't know, written scenes, directed scenes, acted scenes, whatever you want to call it. But when he says, you know, we have people everywhere, and then M's bodyguard pulls out his gun, I thought that was one of the better moments in this movie, and yes. I enjoyed that.
Well, I didn't agree.
I totally agree, Paul, with that being one of the better scenes. But it immediately leads into a nonsensical chase and violence thing. Like, I'm hanging upside down from a rope, spinning around, and I got to grab a gun, and he's got to grab a gun. Like, come on.
Yeah, the scene is nonsensical, but I think it was better directed than the chase at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
But they never answered the mystery. Why did that guy betray him?
Because he was in Hydra.
I mean, you could say that, but the thing is, he had no money. It was more like gambling debt, because he had no money. He had like £100 in his bank account. And beyond that, there was nothing.
Yeah, no, they didn't give him a proper motivation, because they didn't dwell on him after that. He was there for that one shock scene and then for the chase.
Yeah.
But that's I think, to me, that's in a nutshell the problem with this movie. They didn't think out and create the depth of the relationships, the characters, and the story development. They had the ideas. You know, the whole idea of let's see what quantum is, let's, you know, which I guess at the time was before they had reacquired the rights to Spectre, so they were going to make quantum the new thing. But, you know, you needed to establish it, and they didn't. They just kept saying, oh, yeah, there's quantum. You know, well, what is it? You know, what are we afraid of? What does quantum stand for?
It's the Epstein list. Everybody's getting out. They were on the list, guaranteed.
Sometimes you just have to take a leap when it comes to quantum.
Thank you.
Nice.
Thank you very much. I think the correct answer to that is, oh boy. I'll keep going back to it. It's just my expectations, my desires for this movie were so high because they were doing what I wanted them to do. I've always wanted to see that kind of thing where it picks up right where the last one went off, and Casino Royale was so great. I keep going back to, maybe that's why I dislike this one. It's not my most disliked. We're not there yet. But it's pretty bad, and it's bad. It is, Paul, you're right. You watch them back to back. It is less bad,
but it's still bad.
Yes.
Now, you know, when they drown you in oil, if you leave a small patch based in the spine,
now, okay,
it'll be okay.
What's really funny about that, David, I was waiting for one of you guys to bring this up because what I liked about that scene was they didn't do a bunch of ham-fisted, oh, see what we're doing here?
Yep.
They didn't do that. And I liked that they didn't do that, but for the audience, particularly us older guys, that we got what they were doing.
Yeah.
But it was pretty much that.
No. And I got a vibe from when the guy gets pushed off the roof.
That's the road, like Roger Moore pushing
Roger
the
Moore.
The guy from Spy Who Loved Me. Yeah.
Yes.
That's one of the two scenes where Roger Moore is the most Connery. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Except Roger Moore got the answer and then shoved him off the roof.
Yes.
generally the best way to operate, but you know, who am I to say?
Fields' death was a missed opportunity, though. And I loved the throwback to Goldfinger. I got what they were doing there. It looked cool. But what should have come out of that is this like passion for Bond to like go after Green. So the cool thing they did with the can at the end, which I thought these were good ideas that they had there, I just wanted a little more oomph behind them, because when he threw that can to Green, it should have felt like, oh, he stuck it to this guy in a real, it felt flat. Not completely. I thought it was cool. I'm saying that, but I should have been like, yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I didn't feel it on that level. I thought it was cool. But I felt like this should have been a moment that I felt like this film, it's weird to say with how truncated it was, and we talk about how certain things were, it felt like they were a draw. I felt like this should have been a longer movie in the right ways, because there's certain opportunities where they could have fleshed certain things out and added some passion to the sequence. I should have felt something for Fields' death a lot more than I did. Where I wanted to see Bond go after somebody. I wanted to see him get them. And I didn't feel that, not the way that I felt like I should. And I'm used to feeling in some of my favorite Bond movies where I wanted to get him. And Green, I never felt at any point in time that I really wanted him to get Green. I mean, I don't like Green. But it was a mild dislike for him versus the fact, like, I wanted him to go after Mads Mikkelsen in the worst way.
But I think you're hitting on what is the true failure of the movie, and it is a kind of oxymoronic that we're saying it was the shortest one, but it drags in the middle, and it actually would have dragged less had they added some more gravitas to some of the scenes. So actually, you'd be taking this movie that's approximately an hour and 45 minutes and maybe bumping it up to 2 hours by adding 15 minutes of scenes. Maybe, that would probably make it better.
Maybe that much. It doesn't even have to be that much. I mean, one of the projects I'm working right now, I'm actually going line by line, and I collapsed 26 pages down to 20, which was my goal because I had stuff I want to write after that, right? And you get the idea of how precious two lines are on a script page. And there are scenes in this where one back and forth between M and Bond, or somebody else and Bond, Felix and Bond,
would Bond would have added so much that we might be talking about 3 or 4 minutes more. Gives it that oomph, because you're absolutely right that just a little more context on some of this stuff, a little more gravitas, as you said, just has that absolute chance of making this not the one that we regret, but the one like that's the best follow-up of any of these Bond movies. And again, that for me, the absence of it being that is the thing that damns this movie the most.
I totally agree. But, you know, and there's also the factor that, you know, we did a whole series on the Deep Space Nine episodes. And sometimes we would look at an episode and say, well, if they had added in this to explain it, this would have made it better. Now, in that situation, you're dealing with something where you have a hard cap on it. It needs to be whatever it is, 46 minutes or something along those lines.
Probably 44 for most of its duration.
Yeah. So if you added 30 seconds on, you got to find somewhere else to prune 30 seconds off.
Yeah.
This movie
was
this movie was already short, so they probably had no such limitation. Had this movie been, you know, 2.5 hours long, I could see where they'd say, hey, you can't be adding time to this thing. But it was only 1 hour and 45 minutes. Had they added 5, 10, 15 more minutes, it would have had zero impact on the likelihood of people going to see it in the theater.
Absolutely. And also the economics of it, 15 minutes does not create, if you, out of an entire day, does not create one more showing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Movie theaters used to think about that. So they'd go for a comedy that's 1.5 hours. You can show that one more time than you can show a 2-hour drama during the day. Maybe twice if your theater's open long hours.
And I think time has shown us that when they come out with the blockbuster movies that are 3 hours and 3 hours and 20 minutes, they make $1 billion. So that's not the, you know, the time isn't necessarily the issue.
Yeah.
So they certainly could have done it. And again, we'll go back to the fact that the writer's strike was coming and they were probably rushed to put this all together. But when you're dealing with actors of the quality of, say, Daniel Craig and Jeffrey Wright, I could see the two of them sitting there when they're filming their scene and saying, well, why don't we add this in? And why don't we add that in? And you know, they should have been able to do so. But I have no idea what was going on behind the scenes. But it definitely could have been so much better.
Well, what I was saying earlier is that Daniel Craig and the director did add a lot to the script themselves. They were basically writing it along as they went. And, I mean, Craig really hated the experience. He didn't like going into a movie that really didn't have a completed script.
Who wouldn't?
Now, this was interesting in the fact that both Casino Royale and this movie had a villain that Bond didn't kill. You know, he didn't kill the chief, and he didn't kill, what's his name here in this one?
Green.
And he didn't kill Medrano either. He didn't
kill him directly.
No. But Medrano, it was weird because he looked like my my wife's uncle Tino, who just passed away. So it's weird. I mean, he looked just like him. It was scary.
You know, it's a bit of a segue here for a minute. Best movie that didn't have an ending when it started.
Casablanca.
Yeah.
There's...
In the same year, Iron Man didn't have a script going into it, and they made that. And
Iron Man 2.
What?
Iron Man 2.
Iron Man was pretty seat of its pants.
Iron Man
just talked about it. He's like, there was no script.
Yeah, there was no script walking into it. Jeff Bridges didn't know what he was going to be doing one day to the next. And if the funny thing is like, Iron Man had a $140 million budget. And it made $585 million. This one had a $200 million budget and made $4 million more at the box office.
And where the hell did the money go? Oh, yeah, the big explosion. Kablamo!
Didn't they build that hotel out in the desert?
Who the hell would stay there?
People who want to see their hotel explode.
It's things that was
on TripAdvisor. That's one of the things I look for.
Floating toilet.
Great.
You know, that's really my only criticism of the movie is that, in a movie, in a whole series, because Logan and I have continued on. We've been watching, the subsequent Bonds after this, with just taking just the Daniel Craig movies, movies with absolutely stunning and beautiful and incredible set pieces. But the conclusion of this movie takes place in a Motel 6 in the middle of the desert. And I'm like, what the hell? That's really my only criticism of it is, for one, I question, who builds a motel in a desert? But then also the fact that it's...
Green.
It's a pretty underwhelming... Hey, maybe they're related now that you say that. Yeah, but it's a pretty underwhelming set piece.
You're dead on right, man. It is the worst sensibility out of the Roger Moore films. It is a hotel that is designed to explode.
To blow up, yeah.
Yeah.
It has no other purpose.
Yep. Yeah.
It's a question that ranks up there with, why does God need a spaceship?
I think that one of the things that they have to do in these movies is realize people don't like to be stuck in sand. Now, again, my whole...
Especially Anakin.
It's overdone by the heat in the movie theater. But whenever I see just, when you have total segments that are built out in sand, I think of Dune, where I fell asleep. I think of the other movies that have a lot of sand in them where I fell asleep. And you just don't walk away with a positive feeling on that. I still haven't watched all the new Dune movies because I watched the first one and I fell asleep.
Now, maybe we needed a scene where they were going to explain how they were going to divert all the water that they had backed up there to where the hotel was.
And that would have helped.
So it's going to become a fishing lodge.
Exactly.
Blow up the dams.
So, Brian, I've got a question based on your hot movie theater and sand comments.
Mm-hmm.
What movie theater was it?
Oh, gosh. That was, I believe, the Palace, downtown Fort Worth.
Okay.
That's where Kevin and I saw Gladiator.
I never saw anything at the Palace. I went back in the old days to the Ridgely.
Yeah.
But...
There was a scene that I thought was really cool. And the Judi Dench, Daniel Craig passing each other in the hallway thing was awesome. But Mr. White, they set up this whole thing in the beginning. You don't know who we are and we're everywhere. Cool. Bond, when he was pulling off this line, can I offer an opinion? I really think you people should find a better place to meet. And using that as a tool to get people to start getting up so he could take pictures of them. Yeah. Now, all of a sudden, he's poking holes in what White said in the beginning. I thought that was great.
That's a very good point.
Yeah. That was a sequence where I'm like, there's some cool things they were doing in this that if we got a little bit more, I think we could have connected them. But that was neat. I mean, I thought that as far as now we're in this film, we're starting to put some faces, clues, and it starts to build movies outside of this where they now know more than they did walking in. That was really brilliant. It was a very good Bond moment.
Well, it was also a real cool thing, how they were giving everybody those bags. And at that point in time, swag bags were that big thing that was going on in all the media at the time. You were hearing about all the things that they were getting at the Oscars and other places. And so to see that, it was like, okay, yeah, we know what's going on here now.
And him seeing that it was one pulled from under the table.
Yeah.
It was one specifically designated for that person. I thought that was cool, too.
Yeah. Though breaking off the door in the bathroom, that's not going to keep people from going in.
And that door would never break that easy, by the way. He just kind of pulls it and the knob comes in, the metal breaks. Please.
Hey, James Bond.
Yeah. You sounded like, what's her name? Tiffany Case. You just killed James Bond. I'm going to jump to the score now. And, I thought this I saw that it was nominated for something. It was highly thought of. I kind of thought it was almost it didn't really have an impact on me.
I couldn't hum anything from this one.
Well, the only thing that stood out to me was when they would fall back on the regular Bond theme. Otherwise, it didn't stand out. But Scott is my score guy. What do you say?
The magic of this score is, imagine scoring a, let's say, Indiana Jones movie, for example, and you can't use, or rather, not so much you can't use, but you choose not to use the most iconic things from Indiana Jones. And that's kind of the magic of this, is because this is kind of a low-level origin story, as we find out, you know, over the course of these, you know, the Daniel Craig movies, that is setting up the origin of Bond, that this is Bond at the beginning of his career. You know, much like Casino Royale didn't do the Bond theme until the very end of the movie when he's James Bond. That's, you might not catch it. You know, it's one of those things that that Mike over at Red Letter Media likes to say, you know, you may not have recognized it, but your brain did, you know. It's the same thing in Casino Royale. You watch that entire movie, and until the Bond theme plays at the end, you realize, holy shit, we just went this entire movie, and this is the first time we're hearing the James Bond theme. Very similar thing happens with this movie. There is very, very little Bond anywhere in the music in this. It is there a couple of times, because I made note of, like, specifically when they first arrive in, I think it's Haiti, he and the girl, they play a little bit of the Bond theme just very subtly in the background. And there's a couple other
it's sort of laced in there.
Yeah,
laced.
When they hit on the Bond theme, it's not the dun 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 dun.
Right, yeah.
It's more like a slow dun 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 dun.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, it's very light in the background. But what he did, kind of in the John Williams mode, was that he created new themes and motifs that play, that if you start to pick up on them, you realize, okay, he's creating a whole new language that he's using through this movie. And probably the best example of that is when Bond and Mathis, you know, when Mathis wakes up and realizes that Bond's been drinking all night and has never slept, and they have their conversation, he's, you know, talking about forgiveness and all that. Vesper's theme plays very quietly in the background of that, and I love that. David Arnold, in my opinion, is a fantastic composer, very, very underrated, and it makes me sad that this was his last Bond, at least so far. Now, after this, we go to another composer for, you know, for the next two movies, and, you know, we'll talk about that later, but I really, really enjoyed all of the David Arnold ones for different reasons, because the first couple he did were completely bombastic, you know, very in-your-face Bond theme movies. But then with both, you know, these two, Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, he switched gears completely and went to using very little Bond and having to create a whole new audio language and music to operate these films. And I mean, you got to respect that. And I think he did a fantastic job. Is this one a little more backgroundish than, say, Casino Royale? I think maybe so, but.
Well, I mean, let me ask you this, Scott. Do you think, like, in Casino Royale, they had the, you know, my name, Chris Cornell, and this one had Another Way to Die with Alicia Keys and Jack White. And I thought that both times they, you know, the theme worked very well into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
In both cases, were they given the theme from David Arnold, or did they make their songs and David Arnold added those themes into the movie?
I've always wondered that, because I
always thought of it the second.
Yeah, I honestly don't know, because that goes all the way back to John Barry, and, you know, his time scoring most of, you know, what we think of as like the original Bond movies.
We have this wrong, Scott. You know better than I would on this stuff. Didn't Chris Cornell work with him on the theme But on this movie, it was Jack Black wrote it, I thought.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Credit was on the screen, and I realized I just watched it like a couple hours ago, and I've already forgotten.
Yeah, it was Jack White.
I thought it was great.
They called them the White Keys, and I actually thought that this was one of the most forgettable themes.
Yeah.
It wasn't bad like Die Another Day. It was just forgettable.
Oh, the opening song type of thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of forgettable.
Didn't do anything for me. Didn't get me riveted, ready to go. It didn't get me. Like I said, as soon as we finished the opening theme and went into the movie, I forgot the opening theme.
I think everybody did. I don't think it's on anybody's list of best.
Well, unfortunately, the most memorable thing from this movie is the guy pushing the broom that's not hitting the ground. And none of you know what I'm talking about. The scene where the woman and Bond, they wind up on the dock and she goes to Green and Green gives her to Medrano. And Bond comes up and gives the guy there at the gate his card. And if you look in the background, as the guys look at the card, there's a guy sitting there pushing a broom, not touching the ground at all. And this is all over the internet. It's loons. Our listeners know about this and you guys don't. I don't know what's going on here.
Sorry.
I mean, I wasn't that bored to where I was watching the guy in the background non-existently brooming. So, you know, maybe.
It's up there with the stormtrooper banging his head.
Yep.
Now, I guess it's one of those things where once you see it, you can't unsee it. But
unfortunately, that's what I was watching today. I'm like, yep, there's a guy not touching the ground with the broom, and he's just sweeping.
I know I'm going far afield here, but, you know, my favorite movie of all time, as I've said so many times, is The Godfather, which I feel is virtually a perfect movie, except when Sonny goes to punch Carlos and his fist misses by about a foot and Carlos's head snaps back. Yeah. So, you know, these things happen. But once you see them, you can't unsee them. That's the problem.
From Return of the Jedi, you can explain Luke's force kick on the guy that it doesn't connect is him using the force with the kick.
Yeah, true. I'm going to just pull back now and let you guys give any more comments before we rate this. Anybody have anything?
I think it's all kind of been said. This is, it's not the deepest Bond movie. It's not the best Bond movie.
Okay, so sometimes my review of a movie is based upon expectations. And I think, Jeff, you hit it right on the nose. I had extreme expectations for this coming off of Casino Royale, which I think it's not my favorite Bond movie because Goldfinger will always be my favorite Bond movie, but it's right there. It's one of the, I think it's one of the best Bond movies. And I was so on board with that. And then when I saw this, as I said, I thought, huh? This is what they give me after that. On the other hand, you know, it's a tale of two reviews, because when you watch it as a double feature and you sit down and watch, you know, whatever it is, 4.5 hours straight, and watch this and Casino Royale back to back, it's really not all that bad. On its own, if you just watched this and not, you know, with no other basis for Daniel Craig or anything like that, this is a Jaws 4. But when you team it up with Casino Royale, it bumps up to a pretty decent Jaws 3. But I don't see it higher than that, Frank. This is not one of my favorite Bonds by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I'll go. It's for me, I struggled with this too, because Scott said something earlier that it sticks with me. I liked it. I'm not going to pretend that I didn't. But I said, I don't love it. And the reasons why is because I think this is a high Jaws 3 for me with some Jaws 2 concepts. I shared some things that I thought were cool in this one and I wanted to see more of and all of that. And I think it's why I liked this film, because there were things in this that I liked and I wanted to see more of. And I wish this could have achieved that Jaws 2 feel for me, where I'm like, I don't just like this, I love it. So it really falls into the Jaws 3. I forget this movie. I will watch it again because I like the storyline that it's building into. And I'm going to say once again, I am broken record with everything we said before. Watching this after Casino Royale does give it a different flavor. If you're going to watch this one, watch it after Casino Royale. It does play nicely after that. There's a definite thing to it, but Jaws 3 for me, definitely.
Brian, I'm going to just go around the same way we've gone around.
Yeah. I think the word here that skews my rating on this is rewatchability. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, watching it in line with after Casino Royale. And I typically, whenever I watch Casino Royale within the next couple days or weeks, I will end up watching all of them, all the Bond films. And as a result of that, because of that rewatchability, I'm going to give it the lowest possible Jaws 2 that you can possibly give it.
Sure.
Because you're not going to rewatch a Jaws 3. Or not often. And I rewatch the movies every couple of years.
All right, Chris?
I'll just mirror pretty much everybody else. It was confusing and muddled watching it when I got it on video, and I have to watch it back to back with Casino Royale. It's really the only way to do it. I don't think I could give it anywhere close to a Jaws 2, though. It's a middling Jaws 3. I really can't do better than that with it. And it's a shame because, you know, again, so amped up after Casino Royale, and then you kind of get this mostly one part.
Yeah, you're up.
I can readily admit my disappointment came from my expectations. I think that's unavoidable. That said, in rewatching it today, my frustrations were validated. I'm really, really conversant on Casino Royale. I didn't need to rewatch it before this. I got all the references. I got all the dialogue. I even backed it up a couple of times to make sure I was getting things right. And this is only the second time I've watched this movie because it's like a Jaws 4 at best. And the frustration that dwells with this movie for me, not the frustration I had originally, but the frustration that just resonates in this movie, is that there's some great scenes. And the frustration is what might have been.
Yeah. Dave?
Well, I pretty much summed it up already. Like I said, the violence level I felt was over par for a James Bond movie. Particularly the killing of, quote-unquote, the innocent folks. The folks standing in the crowd when he's chasing them in the beginning. The cops. We've had Bond villains killing people. And yeah, I get the whole, I'm going to kill everyone on the earth. But do you know what I'm saying? Shooting and killing innocent folks. It just was a different level of violence for a James Bond movie. Until you said it tonight about, you know, this quantum being everywhere. I never made the Hydra connection, but yeah, that's pretty much what it is. And I know, my inner hopeful person would be like, well, I would hope, you know, in the real world, they'd be able to weed these people out. But seeing the way things go down, I wouldn't be surprised that an organization like this could get folks everywhere. Now, for all that, you know, it did have a few subtle throwbacks, or not so subtle, depending on how you want to look at it, to the old movies. And so for that reason, I'm going to give it a mid to low level Jaws 3. It wasn't a horrible picture. It was somewhat entertaining, but it's not at the top.
All right, Scott, I get the feeling that you were going to be the most optimistic of all.
I'm
Scarecrow.
I'll be honest. I'm kind of stunned by the harsh criticism on this one because I find it a thoroughly enjoyable movie. But again, that's with the caveat that you know, you really have to watch it as a continuation of Casino Royale, because I don't think it stands on its own. And that, you know, that of course is an inherent weakness of any movie if it doesn't quite stand on its own. Also, I think if the worst thing you can say about a movie is that it just wasn't as good as the film before it. I mean, and that's ultimately, that's my biggest criticism is I enjoy it just fine. It's not as good as Casino Royale, but I still find it, you know, a very good movie. You know, at least, you know, watchable and enjoyable. For me, I was trying to figure out, like, what is the thing that works best for me in this? And I think it's any time that Bond goes rogue, so to speak, especially if it's for something he's personally passionate about, that really works for me, because that's one of the reasons I really, really love License to Kill, is that at the end of the day, he says, you know what, to hell with it. I'm going to avenge my friend and the murder of my friend's wife. And that's what really works for me in that movie. In this one, I see him going rogue because while he's doing the whole, you know, thing with Mr. White and Quantum and you know, all of that, chasing all of that for M and doing his job, he's also still playing the long game of getting revenge for Vesper and, you know, that whole thing. And, you know, Sean talked about, you know, the film not having a very satisfying ending. I'm very satisfied that he finally wraps that whole thing up at the end of the movie. The boyfriend gets what's coming to him at the end.
When the boyfriend, you know, this is something we didn't talk about, and we should have got to that, Scott, you're right. The guy's with Stana Katic from Castle, is that he gets his. You know, there is a bit of that. And again, this gets into the thing about why I think the film's so disjointed, because I literally had a note and I still forgot to talk about that.
Actually, Scott, I want to be clear on that part too. It's the reason why I felt that wasn't satisfying is I never bought into him. So that was the reason why. You're right though, as far as did they wrap that up? They did. So, I mean, it's one of those things. So you're 100% correct.
I you know, in the interest of brevity, I'll just say, you know, to me it's a solid Jaws 2. I find it enjoyable, I find it rewatchable, but I can't rewatch it without watching the one before it, or at least getting a good solid recap, because I won't remember what's going on. So, you know, that says whatever that says. But yeah, I like it.
All right. So next time around we're gonna hit Skyfall. So I think we may end up with a slightly more optimistic take on it by then, but we will see. Thanks guys for coming on and joining us, and thank you everybody for listening, and until then, have your martini shaken and not stirred. Bye-bye.
I heard a rumor you'd gone native.
Felix, forget us.
Yes, it is. You know, I was just wondering what South America would look like if nobody gave a damn about cocoa communism. So it would impress me the way you boys carved this place up.
I'll take that as a compliment coming from a Brit.
Are you sure you're playing with the right side?
Regimes change once a week down here. And then I know you're no dirtier than the next guy.
Oh, you see, that's what I like about U.S. intelligence. You'll lie down with anybody.
Including you, brother. Including you.
Do you know you're being played? Dominic Green's going to suck this place dry, and then he's going to move on, and you're going to be left picking up the broken crockery.
What can I tell you? There's no such thing as a free lunch.
Well, you see, Felix, I don't think you're half as cynical as you make out to be.
You don't know me.
Why? Just because you didn't come alone? How long have I gone?
30 seconds.
Well, that doesn't give us a lot of time, does it?